Chapter 2. The White Worker. How America became the laborer's promised land. And flocking here from all the world, the white workers competed with black slaves, with new floods of foreigners, and with growing exploitation, until they fought slavery to save democracy, and then lost democracy in a new and vaster slavery. The opportunity for real and new democracy in America was broad. Political power was at first, as usual, confined to property holders and an aristocracy of birth and learning. But it was never securely based on land. Land was free, and both land and property were possible to nearly every thrifty worker. Schools began early to multiply and open their doors even to the poor laborer. Birth began to count for less and less, and America became to the world a land of opportunity. So the world came to America, even before the Revolution, and afterward during the 19th century, 19 million immigrants entered the United States. The new labor that came to the United States, while it was poor, used to oppression, and accustomed to a low standard of living, was not willing, after it reached America, to regard itself as a permanent laboring class, and it is in the light of this fact that the labor movement among white Americans must be studied. The successful, well-paid American laboring class formed, because of its property and ideals, a petty bourgeoisie, ready always to join capital in exploiting common labor, white and black, foreign and native. The more energetic and thrifty among the immigrants caught the prevalent American idea that here labor could become emancipated from the necessity of continuous toil and that an increasing proportion could join the class of exploiters, that is, of those who made their income chiefly by profit derived through the hiring of labor. Abraham Lincoln expressed this idea frankly at Hartford in March 1860. He said, "I am not ashamed to confess that 25 years ago I was a hired laborer, mauling rails, at work on a flatboat. Just what might happen to any poor man's son." Then followed the characteristic philosophy of the time. "I want every man to have his chance, and I believe a black man is entitled to it, in which he can better his condition, when he may look forward and hope to be a hired laborer this year and the next, work for himself afterward, and finally to hire men to work for him. That is the true system." He was enunciating the widespread American idea of the son rising to a higher economic level than the father, of the chance for the poor man to accumulate wealth and power, which made the European doctrine of a working class fighting for the elevation of all workers seem not only less desirable, but even less possible for average workers than they had formerly considered it. These workers came to oppose slavery, not so much from moral as from the economic fear of being reduced by competition to the level of slaves. They wanted a chance to become capitalists, and they found that chance threatened by the competition of a working class, whose status at the bottom of the economic structure seemed permanent and inescapable. At first, black slavery jarred upon them, and as early as the 17th century, German immigrants to Pennsylvania asked the Quakers innocently if slavery was in accord with the Golden Rule. Then gradually, as succeeding immigrants were thrown in difficult and exasperating competition with black workers, their attitude changed. These were the very years when the white worker was beginning to understand the early American doctrine of wealth and property, to escape the liability of imprisonment for debt, and even to gain the right of universal suffrage. He found pouring into cities like New York and Philadelphia emancipated Negroes with low standards of living, competing for the jobs which the lower class of unskilled white laborers wanted. For the immediate available jobs, the Irish particularly competed, and the employers, because of race antipathy and sympathy with the South, did not wish to increase the number of Negro workers, so long as the foreigners worked just as cheaply. The foreigners, in turn, blamed blacks for the cheap price of labor. The result was race war. Riots took place which were at first simply the flaming hostility of groups of laborers fighting for bread and butter. Then they turned into race riots. For 3 days in Cincinnati in 1829, a mob of whites wounded and killed free Negroes and fugitive slaves and destroyed property. Most of the black population, numbering over 2,000, left the city and trekked to Canada. In Philadelphia, 1828 to 1840, a series of riots took place which thereafter extended until after the Civil War. The riot of 1834 took the dimensions of a pitched battle and lasted for 3 days. 31 houses and 2 churches were destroyed. Other riots took place in 1835 and 1838, and a 2 days riot in 1842 caused the calling out of the militia with artillery. In the 40s came quite a different class, the English and German workers, who had tried by organization to fight the machine, and in the end had to some degree envisaged the Marxian reorganization of industry through trade unions and class struggle. The attitude of these people toward the Negro was varied and contradictory. At first, they blurted out their disapprobation of slavery on principle. It was a phase of all-wage slavery. Then they began to see a way out for the worker in America through the free land of the West. Here was a solution such was impossible in Europe. Plenty of land, rich land, land coming daily nearer to its own markets, to which the worker could retreat and restore the industrial balance ruined in Europe by the expropriation of the worker from the soil. Or, in other words, the worker in America saw a chance to increase his wage and regulate his conditions of employment much greater than in Europe. The trade unions could have a material backing that they could not have in Germany, France, or England. This thought, curiously enough, instead of increasing the sympathy for the slave, turned it directly into rivalry and enmity. The wisest of the leaders could not clearly envisage just how slave labor in conjunction and competition with free labor tended to reduce all labor toward slavery. For this reason, the union and labor leaders gravitated toward the political party which opposed tariff bounties and welcomed immigrants, quite forgetting that this same Democratic Party had as its backbone the planter oligarchy of the South, with its slave labor. The new immigrants and their competition with this group reflected not simply the general attitude of America toward colored people, but particularly they felt a threat of slave competition which these Negroes foreshadowed. The Negroes worked cheaply, partly from custom, partly as their only defense against competition. The white laborers realized that Negroes were part of a group of millions of workers who were slaves by law, and whose competition kept white labor out of the work of the South and threatened its wages and stability in the North. When now the labor question moved west and became a part of the land question, the competition of black men became of increased importance. Foreign laborers saw more clearly than most Americans the tremendous significance of free land in abundance, such as America possessed, in open contrast to the land monopoly of Europe. But here on this free land, they met not only a few free Negro workers, but the threat of a mass of slaves. The attitude of the West toward Negroes, therefore, became sterner than that of the East. Here was the possibility of direct competition with slaves, and the absorption of Western land into the slave system. This must be resisted at all costs, but beyond this, even free Negroes must be discouraged. On this, the Southern poor white immigrants insisted. In the meantime, the problem of the black worker had not ceased to trouble the conscience and the economic philosophy of America. That the worker should be a bond slave was fundamentally at variance with the American doctrine, and the demand for the abolition of slavery had been continuous since the Revolution. In the North, it had resulted in freeing gradually all of the Negroes, but the comparatively small number of those thus freed was being augmented now by fugitive slaves from the South, and manifestly, the ultimate plight of the black worker depended upon the course of Southern slavery. There arose then, in the 30s, and among thinkers and workers, a demand that slavery in the United States be immediately abolished. This demand became epitomized in the crusade of William Lloyd Garrison, himself a poor printer, but a man of education, thought, and indomitable courage. This movement was not primarily a labor movement or a matter of profit and wage. It simply said that under any condition of life, the reduction of a human being to real estate was a crime against humanity of such enormity that its existence must be immediately ended. After emancipation, there would come questions of labor, wage, and political power, but now, first, must be demanded that ordinary human freedom and recognition of essential manhood, which slavery blasphemously denied. This philosophy of freedom was a logical continuation of the freedom philosophy of the 18th century, which insisted that freedom was not an end, but an indispensable means to the beginning of human progress, and that democracy could function only after the dropping of feudal privileges, monopoly, and chains. The propaganda which made the abolition movement terribly real was the fugitive slave, the piece of intelligent humanity who could say, "I have been owned like an ox. I stole my own body, and now I am hunted by law and lash to be made an ox again." By no conception of justice could such logic be answered. Nevertheless, at the same time, white labor, while it attempted no denial, but even expressed faint sympathy, saw in this fugitive slave, and in the millions of slaves behind him, willing and eager to work for less than current wage, competition for their own jobs. What they failed to comprehend was that the black man enslaved was an even more formidable and fatal competitor than the black man free. Here, then, were two labor movements: the movement to give the black worker a minimum legal status, which would enable him to sell his own labor, and another movement which proposed to increase the wage and better the condition of the working class in America, now largely composed of foreign immigrants, and dispute with the new American capitalism the basis upon which the new wealth was to be divided. Broad philanthropy and a wide knowledge of the elements of human progress would have led these two movements to unite, and in their union to become irresistible. It was difficult, almost impossible, for this to be clear to the white labor leaders of the 30s. They had their particularistic grievances, and one of these was the competition of free Negro labor. Beyond this, they could easily vision a new and tremendous competition of black workers after all the slaves became free. What they did not see, nor understand, was that this competition was present and would continue and would be emphasized if the Negro continued as a slave worker. On the other hand, the abolitionists did not realize the plight of the white laborer, especially the semi-skilled and unskilled worker. While the Evans brothers, who came as labor agitators in 1825, had among their 12 demands the abolition of chattel slavery, nevertheless, George was soon convinced that freedom without land was of no importance. He wrote to Gerrit Smith, who was giving land to Negroes, and said, "I was formerly, like yourself, sir, a very warm advocate of the abolition of slavery. This was before I saw that there was white slavery. Since I saw this, I have materially changed my views as to the means of abolishing Negro slavery. I now see clearly, I think, that to give the landless black the privilege of changing masters, now possessed by the landless white, would hardly be a benefit to him in exchange for his surety of support in sickness and old age, although he is in a favorable climate. If the southern form of slavery existed at the north, I should say the black would be a great loser by such a change." At the convention of the New England Anti-Slavery Society in 1845, Robert Owen, the great champion of cooperation, said he was opposed to Negro slavery, but that he had seen worse slavery in England than among the Negroes. Horace Greeley said the same year, "If I am less troubled concerning the slavery prevalent in Charleston or New Orleans, it is because I see so much slavery in New York, which appears to claim my first efforts." Thus, despite all influences, reform and social uplift veered away from the Negro. Brisbane, Channing, Owen, and other leaders called a National Reform Association to meet in New York in May 1845. In October, Owen's World Conference met, but they hardly mentioned slavery. The abolitionists did join a National Industrial Congress, which met around 1845 to 1846. Other labor leaders were openly hostile toward the abolitionist movement, while the movement for free land increased. Thus, two movements, labor-free soil and abolition, exhibited fundamental divergence instead of becoming one great party of free labor and free land. The free soilers stressed the difficulties of even the free laborer getting hold of the land and getting work in the great congestion which immigration had brought, and the abolitionists stressed the moral wrong of slavery. These two movements might easily have cooperated and differed only in matters of emphasis, but the trouble was that black and white laborers were competing for the same jobs, just, of course, as all laborers always are. The immediate competition became open and visible because of racial lines and racial philosophy, and particularly in northern states where free Negroes and fugitive slaves had established themselves as workers, while the ultimate and overshadowing competition of free and slave labor was obscured and pushed into the background. This situation, too, made extraordinary reaction, led by the ignorant mob and fomented by authority and privilege. Abolitionists were attacked, and their meeting places burned. Women suffragists were hooted. Laws were proposed making the kidnapping of Negroes easier and disfranchising Negro voters in conventions called for purposes of reform. The humanitarian reform movement reached its height in 1847 to 1849 amid falling prices, and trade unionism was at a low ebb. The strikes from 1849 to 1852 won the support of Horace Greeley and increased the labor organizations. Labor in eastern cities refused to touch the slavery controversy, and the control which the Democrats had over the labor vote in New York and elsewhere increased this tendency to ignore the Negro and increased the division between white and colored labor. In 1850, a Congress of Trade Unions was held with 110 delegates. They stressed land reform, but said nothing about slavery, and the organization eventually was captured by Tammany Hall. After 1850, unions composed of skilled laborers began to separate from common laborers and adopt a policy of closed shops and a minimum wage, and excluded farmers and Negroes. Although this movement was killed by the Panic of 1857, it eventually became triumphant in the 80s and culminated in the American Federation of Labor, which today allows any local or national union to exclude Negroes on any pretext. Other labor leaders became more explicit and emphasized race rather than class. John Campbell said in 1851, "Will the white race ever agree that blacks shall stand beside us on election day, upon the rostrum, in the ranks of the army, in our places of amusement, in places of public worship, ride in the same coaches, railway cars, or steamships? Never, never. Or is it natural or just that this kind of equality should exist? God never intended it. Had he so willed it, he would have made all one color." New labor leaders arrived in the 50s. Hermann Krieg and Wilhelm Weitling left their work in Germany and their friends Marx and Engels and came to America, and at the same time came tens of thousands of revolutionary Germans. The socialist and communist papers increased. Trade unions increased in power and numbers and held public meetings. Immediately, the question of slavery injected itself, and that of abolition. Krieg began to preach land reform and free soil in 1846, and by 1850, 600 American papers were supporting his program. But Krieg went beyond Evans and former leaders and openly repudiated abolition. He declared in 1846, "That we see in the slavery question a property question which cannot be settled by itself alone, that we should declare ourselves in favor of the abolitionist movement if it were our intention to throw the republic into a state of anarchy, to extend the competition of free working men beyond all measure, and to depress labor itself to the last extremity. That we could not improve the lot of our black brothers by abolition under the conditions prevailing in modern society, but make infinitely worse the lot of our white brothers. That we believe in the peaceable development of society in the United States, and do not, therefore, here at least see our only hope and condition of the extremist degradation. That we feel constrained, therefore, to oppose abolition with all our might, despite all the importunities of sentimental Philistines, and despite all the poetical effusions of liberty-intoxicated ladies. Wilhelm Weitling, who came to America the following year, 1847, started much agitation, but gave little attention to slavery. He did not openly side with the slaveholder, as Krieg did. Nevertheless, there was no condemnation of slavery in his paper. In the first German labor conference in Philadelphia under Weitling in 1850, a series of resolutions were passed which did not mention slavery. Both Krieg and Weitling joined the Democratic Party, and numbers of other immigrant Germans did the same thing, and these workers, therefore, became practical defenders of slavery. Doubtless, the Know-Nothing movement against the foreign-born forced many workers into the Democratic Party, despite slavery. The year 1853 saw the formation of the Arbeiterbund under Joseph Weidemeyer, a friend of Karl Marx. This organization advocated Marxism-Socialism, but never got a clear attitude toward slavery. In 1854, it opposed the Kansas-Nebraska Bill, because capitalism and land speculation have again been favored at the expense of the mass of the people. And this bill withdraws from, or makes unavailable in a future homestead bill, vast tracts of territory, and authorizes the further extension of slavery. But we have do now, and shall continue, to protest most emphatically against both white and black slavery. Nevertheless, when the Arbeiterbund was reorganized in December 1857, slavery was not mentioned. When its new organ appeared in April 1858, it said that the question of the present moment was not the abolition of slavery, but the prevention of its further extension, and that Negro slavery was firmly rooted in America. One small division of this organization in 1857 called for abolition of the slave trade and colonization of Negroes, but defended the Southern slaveholders. In 1859, however, a conference of the Arbeiterbund condemned all slavery in whatever form it might appear, and demanded the repeal of the Fugitive Slave Law. The Democratic and pro-slavery New York Staatszeitung counseled the people to abstain from agitation against the extension of slavery, but all of the German population did not agree. As the Chartist movement increased in England, the press was filled with attacks against the United States and its institutions, and the Chartists were clear on the matter of slavery. Their chief organ in 1844 said, "That damning stain upon the American escutcheon is one that has caused the Republicans of Europe to weep for very shame and mortification. And the people of the United States have much to answer for at the bar of humanity for this indecent, cruel, revolting, and fiendish violation of their boasted principle that all men are born free and equal." The labor movement in England continued to emphasize the importance of attacking slavery, and the agitation, started by the work of Frederick Douglass and others, increased in importance and activity. In 1857, George I. Holyoake sent an anti-slavery address to America, signed by 1,800 English working men, whom Karl Marx himself was guiding in England, and this made the black American worker a central text. They pointed out the fact that the black worker was furnishing the raw material which the English capitalist was exploiting together with the English worker. This same year, the United States Supreme Court sent down the Dred Scott decision that Negroes were not citizens. This English initiative had at first but limited influence in America. The trade unions were willing to admit that the Negroes ought to be free sometime, but at the present, self-preservation called for their slavery. And after all, whites were a different grade of workers from blacks. Even when the Marxian ideas arrived, there was a split. The earlier representatives of the Marxian philosophy in America agreed with the older union movement in deprecating any entanglement with the abolition controversy. After all, abolition represented capital. The whole movement was based on mawkish sentimentality and not on the demands of the workers, at least of the white workers. And so the early American Marxists simply gave up the idea of intruding the black worker into the socialist commonwealth at that time. To this logic, the abolitionists were increasingly opposed. It seemed to them that the crucial point was the matter of freedom, that a free laborer in America had an even chance to make his fortune as a worker or a farmer. But on the other hand, if the laborer was not free, as in the case of the Negro, he had no opportunity, and he inevitably degraded white labor. The abolitionist did not sense the new subordination into which the worker was being forced by organized capital, while the laborers did not realize that the exclusion of 4 million workers from the labor program was a fatal omission. Wendell Phillips alone suggested a boycott on Southern goods and said that the great cause of labor was paramount and included mill operatives in New England, peasants in Ireland, and laborers in South America who ought not to be lost sight of in sympathy for the Southern slave. In the United States, shortly before the outbreak of the Civil War, there were 26 trades with national organizations, including the iron and steel workers, machinists, blacksmiths, etc. The employers formed a national league and planned to import more workmen from foreign countries. The iron molders started a national strike, July 5, 1859, and said, "Wealth is power, and practical experience teaches us that it is a power but too often used to oppress and degrade the daily laborer. Year after year, the capital of the country becomes more and more concentrated in the hands of a few, and in proportion as the wealth of the country becomes centralized, its power increases, and the laboring classes are impoverished. It therefore becomes us, as men who have to battle with the stern realities of life, to look this matter fair in the face. There is no dodging the question. Let every man give it a fair, full, and candid consideration, and then act according to his honest convictions. What position are we, the mechanics of America, to hold in society?" There was not a word in this address about slavery, and one would not dream that the United States was on the verge of the greatest labor revolution it had seen. Other conferences of the molders, machinists, and blacksmiths, and others, were held in the 60s, and a labor mass meeting at Faneuil Hall in Boston in 1861 said, "The truth is that the working men care little for the strife of political parties and the intrigues of office seekers. We regard them with the contempt they deserve. We are weary of this question of slavery. It is a matter which does not concern us, and we wish only to attend to our business and leave the South to attend to their own affairs without any interference from the North." In all this consideration, we have so far ignored the white workers of the South, and we have done this because the labor movement ignored them and the abolitionists ignored them, and above all, they were ignored by Northern capitalists and Southern planters. They were, in many respects, almost a forgotten mass of men. Cairns describes the slave South, the period just before the war. "It resolves itself into three classes, broadly distinguished from each other and connected by no common interest: the slaves, on whom devolves all the regular industry; the slaveholders, who reap all its fruits; and an idle and lawless rabble who live dispersed over vast plains in a condition little removed from absolute barbarism." From all that has been written and said about the antebellum South, one almost loses sight of about 5 million white people in 1860 who lived in the South and held no slaves. Even among the 2 million slaveholders, an oligarchy of 8,000 really ruled the South, while, as an observer said, "For 20 years, I do not recollect ever to have seen or heard these non-slave-holding whites referred to by the Southern gentlemen as constituting any part of what they called the South." They were largely ignorant and degraded. Only 25% could read and write. The condition of the poor whites has been many times described. A wretched log hut or two are the only habitations in sight. Here reside, or rather take shelter, the miserable cultivators of the ground, or a still more destitute class who make a precarious living by peddling lightwood in the city. These cabins are dens of filth. The bed, if there be a bed, is a layer of something in the corner that defies scenting. If the bed is nasty, what of the floor? What of the whole enclosed space? What of the creatures themselves? Puff! Water in use as a purifier is unknown. Their faces are bedaubed with the muddy accumulation of weeks. They just give them a wipe when they see a stranger to take off the blackest dirt. The poor wretches seem startled when you address them and answer your questions cowering like culprits. Olmsted said, I saw as much close packing, filth and squalor in certain blocks inhabited by laboring whites in Charleston as I have witnessed in any northern town of its size, and greater evidences of brutality and ruffianly character than I have ever happened to see among an equal population of this class before. Classes of poor whites have been differentiated, the mountain whites and the poor whites of the lowlands. Below a dirty and ill-favored house, down under the bank on the shingle near the river, sits a family of five people, all ill-clothed and unclean. A blear-eyed old woman, a younger woman with a mass of tangled red hair hanging about her shoulders, indubitably suckling a baby, a little girl with the same auburn evidence of Scotch ancestry, a boy and a younger child all gathered about a fire made among some bricks, surrounding a couple of iron saucepans, which is a dirty mixture looking like mud, but probably warmed up sorghum syrup, which with a few pieces of corn pone makes their breakfast. Most of them are illiterate, and more than correspondingly ignorant. Some of them had Indian ancestors, and a few bear evidences of Negro blood. The so-called mountain boomer, says an observer, has little self-respect and no self-reliance. So long as his corn pile lasts, the cracker lives in contentment, feasting on a sort of hoe cake made of grated cornmeal mixed with salt and water and baked before the hot coals. With addition of what game the forest furnishes him when he can get up the energy to go out and shoot or trap it. The irregularities of their moral lives cause them no sense of shame. But notwithstanding these low moral conceptions, they are of an intense religious excitability. Above this lowest mass rose a middle class of poor whites in the making. There were some small farmers who had more than a mere sustenance and yet were not large planters. There were overseers. There was a growing class of merchants who traded with the slaves and free Negroes and became in many cases larger traders, dealing with the planters for the staple crops. Some poor whites rose to the professional class, so that the rift between the planters and the mass of the whites was partially bridged by this smaller intermediate class. While revolt against the domination of the planters over the poor whites was voiced by men like Helper, who called for a class struggle to destroy the planters, this was nullified by deep-rooted antagonism to the Negro, whether slave or free. If black labor could be expelled from the United States or eventually exterminated, then the fight against the planter could take place. But the poor whites and their leaders could not for a moment contemplate a fight of united white and black labor against the exploiters. Indeed, the natural leaders of the poor whites, the small farmer, the merchant, the professional man, the white mechanic, and slave overseer, were bound to the planters and repelled from the slaves and even from the mass of the white laborers in two ways. First, they constituted the police patrol, who could ride with planters and now and then exercise unlimited force upon recalcitrant or runaway slaves. And then, too, there was always a chance that they themselves might also become planters by saving money, by investment, by the power of good luck, and the only heaven that attracted them was the life of the great Southern planter. There were a few weak associations of white mechanics, such as printers and shipwrights and iron molders in 1850 to 1860, but practically no labor movement in the South. Charles Nordoff states that he was told by a wealthy Alabaman in 1860 that the planters in his region were determined to discontinue altogether the employment of free mechanics. "On my own place," he said, "I have slave carpenters, slave blacksmiths, and slave wheelwrights, and thus I am independent of free mechanics." And a certain Alfred E. Matthews remarks, "I have seen free white mechanics obliged to stand aside while their families were suffering for the necessaries of life, when the slave mechanics, owned by rich and influential men, could get plenty of work. And I have heard these same white mechanics breathe the most bitter curses against the institution of slavery and the slave aristocracy." The resultant revolt of the poor whites, just as the revolt of the slaves, came through migration, and their migration, instead of being restricted, was freely encouraged. As a result, the poor whites left the South in large numbers. In 1860, 399,700 Virginians were living out of their native state. From Tennessee, 344,765 immigrated. From North Carolina, 272,606. And from South Carolina, 256,868. The majority of these had come to the Middle West, and it is quite possible that the southern states sent as many settlers to the west as the northeastern states, and while the northeast demanded free soil, the southerners demanded not only free soil, but the exclusion of Negroes from work and the franchise. They had a very vivid fear of the Negro as a competitor in labor, whether slave or free. It was thus the presence of the poor white southerner in the west that complicated the whole free soil movement in its relation to the labor movement. While the Western pioneer was an advocate of extreme democracy and egalitarianism in his political and economic philosophy, his vote and influence did not go to strengthen the abolition democracy before, during, or even after the war. On the contrary, it was stopped and inhibited by the doctrine of race, and the West, therefore, long stood against that democracy and industry which might have emancipated labor in the United States, because it did not admit to that democracy the American citizen of Negro descent. Thus, Northern workers were organizing and fighting industrial integration in order to gain higher wage and shorter hours, and more they saw economic salvation in the rich land of the West. A Western movement of white workers and pioneers began and was paralleled by a Western movement of planters and black workers in the South. Land and more land became the cry of the Southern political leader, with finally a growing demand for reopening of the African slave trade. Land, more land, became the cry of the peasant farmer in the North. The two forces met in Kansas, and in Kansas, civil war began. The South was fighting for the protection and expansion of its agrarian feudalism. For the sheer existence of slavery, there must be a continual supply of fertile land, cheaper slaves, and such political power as would give the slave status full legal recognition and protection and annihilate the free Negro. The Louisiana Purchase had furnished slaves and land, but most of the land was in the Northwest. The foray into Mexico had opened an empire, but the availability of this land was partly spoiled by the loss of California to free labor. This suggested a proposed expansion of slavery toward Kansas, where it involved the South in competition with white labor, a competition which endangered the slave status, encouraged slave revolt, and increased the possibility of fugitive slaves. It was a war to determine how far industry in the United States should be carried on under a system where the capitalist owns not only the nation's raw material, not only the land, but also the laborer himself, or whether the laborer was going to maintain his personal freedom and enforce it by growing political and economic independence based on widespread ownership of land. This brings us down to the period of the Civil War. Up to the time that the war actually broke out, American labor simply refused, in the main, to envisage black labor as a part of its problem. Right up to the edge of the war, It was talking about the emancipation of white labor and the organization of stronger unions without saying a word or apparently giving a thought to 4 million black slaves. During the war, labor was resentful. Workers were forced to fight in a strife between capitalists in which they had no interest, and they showed their resentment in the peculiarly human way of beating and murdering the innocent victims of it all, the black free Negroes of New York and other northern cities. While in the South, 5 million non-slaveholding poor white farmers and laborers sent their manhood by the thousands to fight and die for a system that had degraded them equally with the black slave. Could one imagine anything more paradoxical than this whole situation? America thus stepped forward in the first blossoming of the modern age and added to the art of beauty, gift of the Renaissance, and to freedom of belief, gift of Martin Luther and Leo X, a vision of democratic self-government, the domination of political life by the intelligent decision of free and self-sustaining men. What an idea and what an area for its realization. Endless land of richest fertility, natural resources such as earth seldom exhibited before, a population infinite in variety, of universal gift, burned in the fires of poverty and caste, yearning toward the unknown God, and self-reliant pioneers, unafraid of man or devil. It was the supreme adventure in the last great battle of the West, for that human freedom which would release the human spirit from lower lust for mere meat, and set it free to dream and sing. And then some unjust god leaned, laughing, over the ramparts of heaven and dropped a black man in the midst. It transformed the world. It turned democracy back to Roman imperialism and fascism. It restored caste and oligarchy. It replaced freedom with slavery and withdrew the name of humanity from the vast majority of human beings. But not without struggle. Not without writhing and rending of spirit and pitiable wail of lost souls. They said slavery was wrong, but not all wrong. Slavery must perish and not simply move. God made black men. God made slavery. The will of God be done. Slavery to the glory of God and black men as his servants and ours. Slavery as a way to freedom. The freedom of blacks. The freedom of whites. White freedom as the goal of the world, and black slavery as the path thereto. Up with the white world, down with the black. Then came this battle called Civil War, beginning in Kansas in 1854, and ending in the presidential election of 1876, 20 awful years. The slave went free, stood a brief moment in the sun, then moved back again toward slavery. The whole weight of America was thrown to color caste. The colored world went down before England, France, Germany, Russia, Italy, and America. A new slavery arose. The upward moving of white labor was betrayed into wars for profit based on color caste. Democracy died, save in the hearts of black folk. Indeed, the plight of the white working class throughout the world today is directly traceable to Negro slavery in America, on which modern commerce and industry was founded, and which persisted to threaten free labor until it was partially overthrown in 1863. The resulting color caste, founded and retained by capitalism, was adopted, forwarded, and approved by white labor, and resulted in subordination of colored labor to white profits the world over. Thus, the majority of the world's laborers, by the insistence of white labor, became the basis of a system of industry which ruined democracy and showed its perfect fruit in World War and Depression. And this book seeks to tell that story. Have ye leisure, comfort, calm, shelter, food, love's gentle balm? Or what is it ye buy so dear with your pain and with your fear? The seed ye sow, another reaps. The wealth ye find, another keeps. The robes ye weave, another wears. The arms ye forge. Another bears. Percy Bysshe Shelley.